Wherever you're listening, if you're in Australia, you're on Aboriginal land. At the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, we pay respects to the elders and acknowledge their ongoing custodianship of the country where we made this podcast, and of the country you're listening to it on. There is something really powerful about switching on the radio and listening to someone just like you.
When I moved to Brisbane as a wide-eyed 17-year-old, I started my degree and I just really wanted to get as much experience in whatever media I could, and I started volunteering for Triple Z, and the show there was Queer Radio. And because the internet was still so slow at that stage, the host, John Frame, would tell me about listeners who would drive for ages just so they could get reception to Queer Radio, to actually hear through the airwaves other queer people sharing their stories, us playing queer music. And that felt like a huge responsibility and honour, actually.
Hearing someone who shares the same problems, the same sense of humour, it helps build community.
When I was at Karma Radio, I was working alongside Warren H. Williams, who was a well-known Aboriginal musician. And I remember his dad at the time used to read the news in Aranda language. I can't remember if it was Western Aranda, but I remember when it got to the weather at one point, he said, according to the Whitefella Euro, the weather's going to be this, because sometimes those forecasts, they try and get it accurate as possible, but they're not always, and Bush people know how to read the weather, probably sometimes better than the Bureau, so that was really funny.
The internet has made it easy to find your tribe. No matter how obscure your hobby, there's a Facebook group for it. But before the World Wide Web was invented, it was community radio that made people feel less alone.
One of the things that I found through coming involved in community radio is really getting to understand the value that community radio can have to individual communities, to individuals themselves, and their sense of connection and their sense of being part of something bigger.
Community radio is a bit like an iceberg. Most of us only see the tip, one or two stations that appeal to us. But in fact, there are more community broadcasters in Australia than there are commercial radio stations, and they have helped all kinds of Australians feel like they belong. You've tuned into Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. I'm Patrick McIntyre, and this is Episode 5, Voices Carry. With more than 450 licensed stations right across Australia, community radio is big. But trying to chart its history is difficult. Nick Henderson, one of the curators at the NFSA, explains why.
Community broadcasting comes out of a range of different areas. It didn't develop as this kind of neat sector. So there'd been a range of ways in which different parts of the community had agitated for more engagement and control. It's useful to look at what they were pushing against and what the scene was like in that earlier period. So in many ways, the Australian kind of media market was quite conservative and looked to repeat a lot of the things in terms of inspiration of the BBC and of Britain and looking at both the government and commercial side over there. You start getting a bit of a shift in the early 1960s with the rise of the music broadcasting services, MBS, in Sydney and Melbourne.
So why did it happen? It was partly about a new technology, frequency modulation, or FM, and it was partly about media ownership, with some proprietors scooping up more and more stations.
So even though there'd been an expansion into the regions in different ways, there was also the consolidation of media through different media market. You've got the Herald and Weekly Times, which had come out of the Murdochs, acquiring a whole lot of stations, and that consolidation drive programming from metropolitan into regional areas using newspapers and pushing that out. And then I guess you've got a whole shift. You've got the inspiration coming through the development from a technical side of the FM band and the agitation more broadly to look at ways to bring FM into the Australian context.
Frequency modulation, or FM, was invented way back in the 1930s. But not for the last time, Australia was slow to embrace a new format. Lobby groups, such as the Listeners Society of New South Wales, campaigned for years to get FM introduced. They knew the extra bandwidth would bring a whole heap of opportunities.
And so from the 1960s, inspired by different moves, perhaps more from the US, there was a desire to look at the way that educational stations could expand and promote educational efforts, particularly from the universities. You also have a whole range of what at the time were probably more likely to be called ethnic or non-English speaking background communities who were interested in getting more space on the airwaves. We're talking about communities who didn't have access to publishing in the same way. You also have a broader kind of interest in terms of a community engagement with the sector that was particularly coming out of a student movement. So looking at the late 1970s, looking at the activism that came around in that period and the university context, there was a kind of real agitation to have a youth engagement. They didn't see that the commercial or government broadcasters represented what their interests were. It's really all of these things coming together.
This push from groups who wanted to get their voices heard was happening right around the world. Some people even set up their own unlicensed stations. And it's not that hard to get yourself onto the airwaves, much easier than setting up your own TV station anyway. Illegal stations like Draft Resistor at Melbourne University and People's Radio at Monash University were part of a global wave known as pirate radio.
Now a word from your science correspondent. That's me, the smart guy. Oh, me hearties. Whoops. Sorry, wrong podcast. Anyway, unlike legal community radio stations, pirate radio refers to the illegal broadcasting of radio signals without the proper authorization from radio authorities. These unauthorized radio stations, often operating from ships or other mobile platforms, gained prominence during the mid-20th century, particularly in the 1960s and 1970s. These stations, they played popular music and often provided an alternative lineup to the more conservative and legal official programming of the time. While pirate radio was more popular in the United Kingdom and the United States, there were reports of it happening locally too. In 1948, DIG, the Digger station, broadcast anti-communist messages for 24 minutes, jamming Melbourne's commercial station 3UZ for 10 minutes! Back to regular programming.
But what really kicked things off was when they finally got around to introducing FM in 1974. And oddly enough, one of the key events was the introduction of Medicare. To explain this new system to people, the government launched two stations, 3A and 2EA, broadcasting in various languages. Those stations were the precursor to SBS Radio, which today reaches an estimated 4 million Australians and broadcasts in 68 languages.
It was really bringing in a whole range of threads, and there was a lot of work being undertaken by a lot of people, community groups, associations, and government of different spectrums of politics. And it was obviously a period of political flux as well with the Whitlam government, who did have a specific interest in community broadcasting, but who dragged their feet in different ways. So you've got the rise of SBS, and you've got the shift of programming that happened with these license structures, which didn't really consolidate until the late 1970s.
These stations were run by volunteers on a shoestring budget, so there's not a lot of archival tape left, because they usually had to reuse what they had. But we do know that community radio was a game changer for many minority groups.
Another side is also First Nations. Aboriginal broadcasting was also something that was really developing, particularly in the 1970s, inspired by a lot of these activities, by the ethnic broadcasting side and by the kind of rise of education on other sides, as an opportunity to engage communities, remote and disparate communities, as well as others, to program in language, to language revitalization, a whole range of things that were going on.
Hello, I'm
When I lived in both Broken Hill and Alice Springs at various times, I love listening to the radio when I'm in those towns, and especially community radio, because everybody knows everybody and you're often hearing about stories that are really localized. They're stories that have meaning and putting faces to the names of people and projects that they're working on. So I think they're a great source of information for local news, national news, and also world news too. So it's really important.
This is Angela Bates talking.
I'm both a Māori and Aboriginal woman. My iwi on my mum's side is Te Whānau Ā'apanui and Ngāti Kahununu, with links to Whakatūhiha. On my father's side, my language groups are Malingapa, Wanyuwākau and Wadigali, with strong links to Barkindji country, which is on the Darling River, the Barker. I grew up in Broken Hill in far western New South Wales, close to the South Australian border. And my traditional country is Murrawindji National Park, and our links to country extend past Tipperborough right up to the South Australian border and beyond.
Angela is the head of the First Nations Department at Screen Australia and has worked in media for over 23 years.
Being a country girl from the country, radio was a big thing for us, I think, out in the bush. And I remember my dad used to call it the wireless, and we'd listen to it mainly in the car. But my media career actually started out in radio in 2000.
Angela started as a trainee at the Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association in Alice Springs, or CAMA. It founded the earliest radio station fully run by First Nations people in 1982.
It's really important to have a voice and a platform for Aboriginal people to be able to talk about their issues that relate to us from our perspective, as instead of coming from a non-Indigenous perspective. But also it was a great way to get communications out to communities and for Aboriginal communities to broadcast in their languages.
There are now more than 100 First Nations radio stations, but CAMA was the pioneer. And they've always tried different technologies, from today's satellite and digital services to the cassettes they used in the early years, so that communities outside the broadcast area could still hear the programs. And those programs have been remarkably diverse.
You all, wherever you are, this is Aboriginal Radio. It's 8:25. Today we've got a great lineup for you. At 8:30, there's the Pitch and Jar Show with Colin Pound. 9 o'clock, we've got the Aboriginal news in English, and after the news, Sabella Turner with the Arana program.
When I started my radio career, I started out as a trainee broadcaster, so I did like the Indigenous music show and an R&B show and things that I liked. But very quickly, I moved into the CAMA newsroom and did a traineeship as a reporter. And I started up Legal Show on CAMA Radio. It was a weekly legal show, and it was sponsored at the time by the Northern Territory Law Society. And it was a really vital program in being able to give mob in the communities information about what their legal rights are in civil, criminal and family law. So I think that was really important, especially because we have really high incarceration rates, and sometimes people are getting locked up just for not paying a fine and really minor incidences. That was a really important program.
Then there's Beyond the Bars.
Hi, my name is Tani. I'd like to say a quick hello to my father, Greg, and my brother, Aaron. I just want to let you know that I love you and I'm thinking of you.
For more than 20 years, Melbourne's Radio 3CR has been broadcasting this show live from Victoria's prisons.
Hi to all my people out there, especially those behind bars. My name is Tracy. I belong to the Wathaurong people in the Ballarat area of Aboriginal Australia. I am a mother of three. I have one daughter and two sons.
It features songs, stories, opinions and poems from First Nations men and women on the inside, connecting them with culture and with community.
My elders, uncles and aunties that have given me the support and the strength to survive this prison journey. Us Indigenous sisters in custody have good contact with our outside people in the community. Our culture is alive and strong in here.
The herald fairies shout, gay is good and gays are out. Out of closets, out to say, liberation's on its way. Some they laughed at.
Another group finding their voice was the gay community. Here's Nick Henderson again.
Gay Liberation Radio Collective was part of the range of community groups that set up 3CR. And they had the first program in Australia in 1976 when the station started broadcasting.
The Gay Liberation Choir folded this year In this segment, members of the then newly formed choir spoke to Gay Wave Sydney on May 28, 1981.
You start seeing the kind of programs in the same way on the First Nations side. They were popping up all around Australia and expanding their programming from half hour to 3 hours in a number of cases, often later at night.
You're listening to a Lesbian and Gay Radio special on Community Radio 3CR on Stonewall Day.
But it was a regular program when most of the community publishing and media that was happening at the time was largely, at best it was fortnight, but mostly it was monthly. So the kind of timeliness and the ability to push information out around events, around actions and activity, protests and other things was quite significant. So it became a really important hub of information and networking.
Fred Nile has said that next year there will be no gay Mardi Gras. Now, what I've said is fine, we'll have a riot.
You don't have to be paranoid these days to believe that there's a tide swinging against gays and lesbians. Thatcher's Section 28 in Britain, which outlaws any local council promotion or support of homosexuality, is the classic case in point. But closer to home, we have our very own Fred Nile in the New South Wales Upper House. It's not exactly an easy time to be gay.
In 1979, Sydney's first gay and lesbian radio program, Gay Waves, went to air. It was groundbreaking during a time when homosexuality was still illegal for men in New South Wales.
That ran for many years on a monthly basis. So they're creating space, they're giving voices, and you see them becoming these spaces for intersectionality, ensuring that there's equal women and men in terms of the representation. The Gay Waves program on 2SER alternated generally between a majority of women and majority men in terms of their programming.
Now that struggle for homosexual law reform is not an easy struggle. It has its highs and its downs. And this morning was obviously a down, but tonight is a high.
Now!
What do we want?
Gay rights!
When do we want them?
Now!
What do we want?
Gay rights!
Now!
Gay rights!
Gay Waves was quite significant in the Sydney context, partly because it was the first in Sydney. It started broadcasting initially with a half-hour slot in November 1979, but quickly moved to a three-hour slot. And that length of time allowed it to expand the type of programming.
It's whizzing by, and we haven't got through all our requests. This seems like an important one. It's from Daniel to Brad, and the message is he loves you. So we didn't get know what track it was, but it seemed only one that was appropriate on this record for Brad.
They did a lot of interviews, and they did a lot of engagement. They did a huge amount of work, educational aspects, particularly around HIV. There's a lot of humour. There's a lot of interesting music. They're interviewing musicians and business people and all range of people. And for many who were involved, were also involved in other collectives.
Writer, journalist and broadcaster Benjamin Law started his career on Brisbane Community Radio 4ZZZ, presenting the program Queer Radio on the Graveyard Shift.
It was a little bit after hours. We could talk more candidly about queer things. But it was weird and hilarious as well, because there were some moments where I was just like, is this okay what we're talking about, or is this the way we frame stuff? Because I was just still a little baby queer myself. So as much as I'm hosting Queer Radio, I'm still learning about my queer identity and the queer community. And so I guess you're hearing me learn the ropes both technically as a radio presenter and also as a queer person. And there were just some hilarious moments where sometimes we would talk about sexual health and stuff. And because there was a big generational difference between the presenters, myself and Emma, who was the co-host, a straight ally, we would talk about sexual health announcement, blah, blah, blah. And then John, who was from another generation, he was just like, and remember, before anal sex, it is important to void one's bowels. And then there'd just be dead air because I didn't know how to respond. And cut forward to now, decades later, I'm still not sure how to respond.
A huge amount of community radio is produced outside the major cities. Two-thirds of community radio stations operate in regional and remote areas, and that's nothing new. The School of the Air was founded in Alice Springs in 1951 to provide education for kids in remote, regional areas.
We cross now to school.
Good morning, girls and boys. Good morning, parents and supervisors.
They didn't have enough population to sustain a school. For some kids living on far-flung cattle stations, the School of the Air was not just a virtual classroom, it was their only connection with the outside world.
Well, who'd like to sing the school song for us?
All the little children scattered through the outback tune into School of the Air at the start, and we sing as we listen to many sad recordings.
And during emergencies like the 2019 bushfire crisis, public service radio is literally a lifeline. Unlike phone signals and the internet, AM radio doesn't collapse when too many people tune in, as this grab from the documentary series From the Embers makes clear.
On the ground, we had no electricity, no phone reception, just the information coming from the radio.
Fire activity is increasing. It's now too late to leave. Seek shelter as the fire approaches. For Mogo, Bimbimbi and Mogandoura continue to monitor
Rogo,
conditions.
Yowri and Verona, it's too late to leave.
Badger Road between Kambagani and Boggy Plain, monitor
there
conditions.
There is an evacuation order in place.
The Bumbo
for
Creek fire has just gone to emergency level, and these fires are out of control. A number of bushfires.
Dampier State Forest fire, which is also at emergency fire. This is on the King's.
The problem is, AM radios are starting to disappear. And unless that changes, according to a recent Australian government report, lives could be at risk. The report says AM radio has been essential during emergencies like fires and floods, including telling residents when and how to evacuate. The report says people in high-risk areas need to maintain those AM receivers. Community radio is important in other ways too. Community and alternative stations have opened career paths for those shut out of mainstream radio. And for many years, that included women. Here's Benjamin Law again.
From when I was listening to CFM, it would usually be a male voice or two male voices, and if you were lucky, two male voices, and the token female. So it'd be like Whopper, Stavvy, and Libby. It was always that kind of combination. I remembered when I tuned into Triple J and then I heard way more female voices. I heard Caroline Tran, I heard Helen Razor, I heard Judith Lucy. And in fact, Helen Razor and Judith Lucy being on the same show was such a big deal that they called it the Ladies' Lounge, which was like really cutting edge at the time. Now you look back and it would be retrograde if you did that now. It's like two women on air. You don't need to, you know, shine a spotlight on the fact that it's two women. I do think demographics and audience expectations changed over time, but I do wonder whether that's the case in commercial radio. Public broadcasters, especially the ABC, have a long way to go too. So when Beverly Wang and I started co-hosting Stop Everything,
that's an ABC Radio National show and podcast devoted to pop culture.
We would get comments on social media from RN listeners calling us the diversity pick, or questioning why it was that two Asians were co-hosting a show. And I think that's a reflection of the listenership, but I also think it's a reflection of the real lack of industry kind of awareness that we're such a multicultural nation and media has taken such a long time to catch up. And I still think like it really hasn't. The streets that I walk down, especially in Australian cities, aren't like the lineups of radio, whether it's commercial or public.
There's another group that had to fight to get their voices onto the airwaves, young people. Youth station FBI Radio launched in Sydney in 2001.
Here we go. Let's do this.
Lorna Clarkson, who you might remember from episode 3, was there in the early days.
When I started at FBI, I was actually one of the first presenters. I was the first presenter of Monday Sunset. I think I was on air the first day we were on air. So really, really at the beginning. good friend of mine, Megan Loder, was basically a station manager, set up the whole station. She'd been trying to get the station its license for many years prior to that. So it was really exciting when FBI was awarded the license. It was such a specific license as well, which is what I loved. It gave it a very clear parameter, which was this is going to be a youth station. It was going to be run by young people for young people. So it was very clear what the goal was from day one. I think the existence of FBI after coming out of 2SER was a breath of fresh air. 2SER is an incredible station. I'm still on 2SER, so I have deep love for it. But it can't be everything to everyone. And while it was my youth station in the 90s, it wasn't the youth station it needed to be in the 2000s. So FBI came along and had teenagers on air, 16-year-olds for the first time, coming on air and making radio the way that they wanted radio to sound, which can't come from a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old. It has to be ideated and imagined and created by the person who wants to hear it. And that is how it should be.
And that's as good a way as any of describing community radio, made by the people, for the people. And if some of those people end up moving into the mainstream media, well, that's a plus too.
And we have so many successful programs and successful mob that at that time, you know, really didn't get a look in from mainstream media. I think the media has progressed a lot since I started out. And, you know, there's a lot more sort of mainstream stations now featuring Indigenous talent and talking about Indigenous issues and supporting Indigenous talent to be able to tell those stories too, more importantly, so it's coming from an Indigenous perspective, from an authentic place.
Community radio is integral to allowing people like myself, who are probably passion-driven rather than career-driven, to open up that opportunity to try things out, to learn things on the job, and to be able to watch and learn and do it in a way and in a medium and around a content, piece of content, like for me, dance music, that makes sense to you. I think sometimes when you look at or listen to commercial radio, it is so highly polished and it sounds quite orchestrated that you think, I can't connect to it myself personally. But when I went into 2SER and later FBI, it was very much about you creating what you wanted to create on air and having a point of difference. And that kind of less polish, more passion was actually the thing that helped these stations rise above maybe what the commercial stations were offering for people like myself. So people who are more specialist in their tastes or what they wanted to listen to on radio. So I think the purpose of community radio and the fact that community stations exist, I can't say enough about how much they add to the integrity of not just music programming, but journalism, the dissemination of information, and just giving alternative voices a platform to share stories, share ideas, and help our whole community open up their minds around who we live with, who we live next to, what people think, how they create. I just hope that community radio continues to have a space and a very strong voice in Sydney, Melbourne, Australia, around the world into the future, because I think without it, we'd be very monocultural.
Thanks to community radio, a whole host of new voices made their way onto the airwaves. But now digital technology and podcasts are pushing that frontier even further. In our next and final episode, we chart how digital tech has changed radio and what's coming next.
And I think what took a lot of these broadcasters by surprise was the upstart nature of new entrance into podcasting, people who had not had the imprimatur of established radio, people who just shoved the door open themselves and started doing whatever they wanted to in the podcasting space.
This has been Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. Thanks to our guests, Angela Bates, Benjamin Law, Lorna Clarkson, and NFSA curator Nick Henderson, and our science correspondent, Andy True. If you've enjoyed Who Listens to the Radio, don't forget to rate or review wherever you get your podcasts. You can visit our Radio 100 digital exhibition at nfsa.gov.au.